From WIPR, I'm Sheila Kast. We're on the record. In our monthly pulse check with the alternative weekly Baltimore Beat, managing editor Brandon Soderberg shares his experience reporting from the robbery, extortion, and fraud trial of two former members of the Baltimore Police Gun Trace Task Force. Soderberg said it's affected him more than any trial he's covered.
It's been really intense. This is sort of an endless series of explosive pieces of information, everything from what these police officers did to how they did it to just really casually the names of other police officers that seem inevitably will also be involved in this.
The Beat has labeled this week its annual sex issue. Editor-in-chief Lisa Snowden-McRae takes us on a visit to the legendary Millstream Inn Gentlemen's Club. On the record, after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Kast. We're On the Record. Since the Baltimore Beat launched last November, On the Record has welcomed a relationship with the city's alternative weekly. We invite them most months to share an issue, and back with us today is the Beat's editor-in-chief, Lisa Snowden-McRae. Hi, Lisa.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Sure. And also with us is managing editor Brandon Soderberg. Welcome back.
Thank you.
This week's Beat includes a detailed dispatch from the Gun Trace Task Force trial. Eight Baltimore City police officers have been charged with criminal activity, including drug dealing and robbery, going back several years. Six officers have pleaded guilty to various charges, but two officers, Daniel Hersel and Marcus Taylor, pleaded not guilty to charges of robbery, extortion, using a firearm to commit a violent crime, and fraud relating to theft of overtime. The trial is in its third week. Brandon, you've been covering this.
Yes, I have.
What has it been like in the courtroom?
It's been really intense. I feel like in contrast to a lot of trials, even big trials, they can feel kind of tedious or boring or they belabor the point of what we're actually there for. But this is sort of an endless series of explosive pieces of information, everything from what these police officers did to how they did it to just really casually the names of other police officers that seem inevitably will also be involved in this. It's really shocking to be sitting there and have officers that are testifying or even drug dealers or alleged drug dealers. Or just regular people they robbed, these cops robbed, and they'll be like, oh, so-and-so, they'll just name another officer who's not of that core eight that have been indicted. So it kind of just keeps going, it keeps exploding, and mainly what you're seeing over and over again is a lot of the same systemic problems you'll see in Baltimore already, which is there's a kind of, I'm going to steal a line from my colleague Baynard Woods of The Real News, we've been reporting on this together, is there's a kind of Calvinist look at crime. The same way there's a Calvinism in the sense of like, you're either born criminal or you're not. If you're a police officer, you can't do anything that's considered criminal. If you're an alleged drug dealer or you're essentially black in Baltimore, you are assumed guilty. That means cops can come up to you, they can take your drugs or your money or your guns or whatever. They have to ask, they can throw you down, they can take it. That's what you're seeing over and over again, is just simply no empathy, understanding for what it's like to be black in Baltimore. You're seeing it again. If you want to understand why something like the uprising happened, it's really because of things like this, this sort of presumed guilt of especially young black men.
One of the officers broke down several times?
Yes.
Who was this and what was happening?
And I would say that's also, it's the only trial I've ever covered where I've cried during it. I've cried two different times myself, one of which was about the same moment, which is Jamel Ryan, one of the officers who has already been indicted, pled guilty. He was testifying about a moment in which these officers, one of the things they would do is they'd sort of eye people up, someone with a backpack or something like that, be like, that guy probably has drugs. Sometimes they were right, sometimes they had additional information, but none of this was tied to warrants or any sort of like proper search and seizure. So they chase this guy out of a gas station downtown. He drives, it's raining, it's about 10:30 at night. They're chasing him. There's also no chase policy in Baltimore, so you're not actually allowed to do what they're doing in the first place. This man who's running from the police goes through a red light. He gets T-boned by someone. The cars go up on the sidewalk, and the officers are sitting in two cars, and they're sitting there, and they're watching it. And
they're behind the car they were chasing.
Yeah, they're like
they're
a street away, and they're watching it, and their discussion is, let's just sit tight, don't call, don't do anything about it. We don't want to be connected to it. And they sit there, and they wait until They hear on the police radio that someone else has called it in, and then they have a long debate about how they're going to kind of cover up the possibility that they could be tied to this. And we know all this because there's an FBI wiretap in one of the cars. So we have this. You actually hear this audio. Then you hear former Detective Ryan kind of tell the story of it. And he was sort of one of the ones in the audio as well. In some ways, he's seen as one of the most ruthless ones, including some home invasions unrelated to robbery, just cops robbing people, not even as cops. But in this case, he was really one of the ones who was saying, we need to do something about this. We're police officers. And the main sort of head, Wayne Jenkins, Sergeant Wayne Jenkins and Daniel Hursall, kind of say, now we're just going to sit tight. We don't want to get caught. And then they discuss the possibility of changing their slips for that day so that it shows they didn't even work during the time of the accident, so they would not be in any way connected to it. So that's just like an example.
What happened to the people in the cars?
I'm actually having trouble finding that out, and I know that I don't believe they died. The quote from former Detective Ryan was, it was bad, real bad. That's kind of seared in my head when he said that. But we don't actually know. It's kind of been hard to follow up on. I know a couple of the reporters have been asking for the actual basic, like, accident report and all that stuff, and we should be able to see the camera footage of all that, but we don't know. But they're at least severely injured. That's about all I know about that, actually. I haven't had time. I've been covering it, but I am very interested to see what happened there exactly.
You write that one witness, Ronald Hamilton, whose home was raided without a warrant by the Gun Trace Task Force in July 2016, was screaming from the stand that his life had been destroyed. Is it clear how many tainted cases there are that involved officers who've been charged?
What we've seen in the trial itself, there's kind of four to six, I'd say, clear examples they kind of keep going back to because they have video or audio evidence of it. But attorney Deborah Levy has said that it could be up to thousands. It's certainly in the hundreds. Ivan Bates, who's running for state's attorney, who's also a lawyer who's represented some of the people that are victims of the task force, he passed out a packet at a press conference on Friday that kind of listed all the cases. It's like at least 150 cases right in there. So there's kind of an endless amount of cases tied to these guys that need to be looked up that could be entirely false, certainly are falsified, certainly were like searches and seizures that shouldn't have happened, or say they would take $20,000 out of someone's glove box. They got a tip that they're a drug dealer, and they would keep 10, and they'd say they seized 10, so they'd keep half of it and only give to the police, you know, the other half of it. So there's sort of this a loop of money and drugs and guns that they're taking, keeping, reselling, and that kind of thing. The most extreme version being that apparently Sergeant Wayne Jenkins, who won an award for his bravery on the day of April 27th during the rioting, during the uprising, was also selling drugs that were stolen from the pharmacy. So it's a direct possibly a direct connection between the unrest, the chaos that happened afterwards, allegedly because of all the drugs, and a police officer literally profiting from those drugs.
That's Brandon Soderberg, managing editor of the Baltimore Beat, here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Also with us is The Beat's editor-in-chief, Lisa Snowden-McCray. We're talking about this week's issue of The Beat, which is available online and on stands right now. So, Lisa, you're the editor-in-chief. What goes through your mind as you watch this reporting come in, these observations from this trial?
Really, Brandon and Baynard's work has been amazing because it didn't just start with The Beat. Like, they've been covering this stuff pretty doggedly, you know, for a few years now, back when we were both at City Paper. And I think that a lot of the ways that they covered this stuff is not the way that news is conventionally covered in Baltimore or anywhere else. A lot of people have been saying that this stuff was going on, and they were telling Brandon and Boehner. I mean, they were also telling other members of the news media, but it felt a lot like Brandon and Boehner were the only ones that would take them seriously. Like, I think one of the kind of rules of journalism is that you take what the police say and you kind of quote it without thinking. And, you know, we see now that that is extremely problematic to do so. It emphasizes what I think has been all of our priority, which is like listening to everyone and being fair to everyone.
Brandon, what do you see as pivotal moments or a pivotal moment in the trial?
I think the pivotal moment kind of was this moment where the man you mentioned, Mr. Hamilton, kind of exploded. And I say that because it sort of, you know, trials get bogged down in kind of tedious legal things. Like, really, it's the question, the real debate of this trial in terms of charges is whether this is robbery or theft. The argument for Detective Herschel is it was theft. He rightfully obtained the cash and the drugs from drug dealers. His only violation was that he didn't then put it into evidence. He took it, which there's endless amounts of evidence that say it was taken by force, and that's a robbery, is taken by force versus just theft. Anyway, I feel like this moment was crucial when Mr. Hamilton sort of screamed at everyone, "You ruined my life, you ruined my family." He mentioned how his kids are terrified because these cops rolled up in the house and raided it. His wife waits at Walmart down the street until he gets home. She doesn't go in the house alone. I say that's a pivotal moment because what it really does is show you like the sort of emotional wreckage. It's not even just like, if you're the kind of person that thinks that like people who deal drugs are just inherently bad and have no rights anymore, well, what about their family? What about these? It keeps spiraling out. And the other kind of massive thing would be the potential the revelation yesterday by former detective Gondo that there was a police shooting in 2009 involving former detective Ryan, which he killed someone and shot the guy point blank, and then that essentially a high up in the police department, Dean Palmer, helped them cover it up. And then yesterday, hours after Gondo said this on the stand, Palmer retired.
I should note that Palmer said he did not coach.
Yes, he did. Yeah, that's important to stress. I'm sorry.
Another piece of Detective Gondo's testimony implicated Detective Sean Souter in criminal behavior. Souter was killed with his own gun last November, the day before he was to testify in federal court about the Gun Trace Task Force. What impact do you think that testimony from Detective Gondo will have on how the department investigates Detective Souter's death?
You would assume or you would hope that the department already knows that information. It's not public information, but perhaps they don't. We did have also Umar Burley, who was a man who was part of had drugs planted on him by Wayne Jenkins. Souter was present. This is back in 2010. There's also a car crash they possibly caused. We're not sure yet. All these car crashes, all these planted drugs. So Umar Burley claimed that Souter was wearing a mask and ran up on him on that day as well. So we've had it has sort of just been, I think everyone wants to really make sure that Souter, who is dead, who was killed with his own weapon, is honored. But I think we've been a little afraid, both the media and the city, to potentially implicate Souter in this. And yesterday when Gondo, a former detective, certainly one who is corrupt, did say that Souter, robbed people with them back in 2010. I don't really know what it means. I think the police department needs to reconcile with this, and they need to sort of move forward with this. And they kind of just keep, they refuse to let anyone be critical or question the narrative because it's a dead police officer. And I think we need to start questioning. This is Charlotte's show, and we should question everything with the police at this point.
You wrote, quote, "Increased violence did not only offer more opportunities for overtime fraud, but it gave the officers a wider latitude in further criminal activity, creating a viciously circular logic for profit," end quote. Unpack that for us. How did the overtime connect with the other alleged crimes?
So the overtime is really just complicated. It's a hustle in the sense that they're always claiming overtime. And then they're being asked to take more guns off the streets. And when they get a gun, they get some form of overtime, however. So every time they obtain a gun, they're given what's called slash days. This has been said by three different officers who testified as common practice. You get a gun, you get the next day off, paid day off. Not legally a paid day off, but you don't have to go to work and you get paid. So it creates this world where they're just really out there to grab guns. Not so much, So there was a thing. Former Detective Gondo said yesterday, on Monday, where he said that if they got a gun by 4:15, they were done for the day. Drop the gun off and go home. And when you pair that with the potential, the allegations, which that they were profiting off the drugs stolen during the uprising, which, as Commissioner Batts, our former commissioner, said at the time, created the homicide spike. You have a direct connection between police officers and a homicide spike. So then the homicide spike goes up because police officers are involved in massive amounts of drug dealing. Then they get to have more overtime. They're not like, they can just file whatever they want because the rank and file are, frustrated, morale is down. Encourage officers that don't have that, whose morale is up, to work more, give them free rein over overtime. So then that goes up. So it's kind of this big loop of like, they're creating violence indirectly or directly by planting guns, by selling drugs, which is a massive disruption of a drug market. Suddenly cops are dealing drugs. It's going to completely screw it up. It's going to lead to murders. There's at least one murder that connects to them, which is a man they robbed who was killed later because he couldn't pay his drug dealer. But I think we'll see more of that. And so it's kind of this loop of like the cops, the unrest happens and because of Freddie Gray's death in police custody. So then there's this riot, and then after the riot, there's a lot of drugs stolen. Police are involved in stealing these drugs. The homicide rate goes up. It kind of keeps going. So they have more. They can just keep feeding it. Their violence creates the opportunity for them to police harder and create more violence and to file more overtime and spend more money. In all, in 2016, the 9 Gun Trace Task Force officers, one, John Kuhl, is yet to be indicted, and by most accounts, even in the trial, is pretty clean other than overtime. He has some crazy overtime. But they, and just in overtime alone, these 9 officers almost earned an extra $500,000 if you combine all their overtime. So it's $500,000 that they essentially stole.
Lisa, do you have any thoughts about what this means for the Baltimore Police Department going forward? I mean, for example, the new police commissioner, Daryl D'Souza, has said he wants to reinstate plainclothes policing in Baltimore. How do you think the testimony from this trial will affect that plan?
It's frustrating because it would seem like, you know, we started this conversation talking about these bombshells in this courtroom, and it would seem like this would be what kicked off revolutionary change. But already, you know, last week, we have these stories coming out, you know, Justin Fenton of The Sun reporting, Brandon and Boehner reporting, and we have D'Souza and Pugh kind of saying, well, these are some bad apples. Mayor Catherine Pugh, saying that these are bad apples. Or I think it was they want to start a new internal, and maybe help me out with this.
Yesterday's revelations or Monday's revelations about potentially about Palmieri and other officers, they've announced a kind of corruption unit that's inside the department, which means it'll be an internal department investigation. We'll never know the answers to it, which is kind of what got us to this point. For example, Daniel Hursel, one of the 8 officers, one of the ones on trial right now, he has at least 20 internal affairs files against him over the past 20 years. I've heard it's way more than that. That's the kind of information. We don't have any access to that. So we don't have access to that. What makes any of us think they're going to give us access to this investigation? So we have another internal investigation when the entire problem with this thing is that they only have internal investigations.
Right, right. So until we start seeing some new solutions from leadership, I don't see how any of this will change.
Well, you've given us a lot to think about. Brandon, thank you very much for your reporting on this.
Well, thank you.
Baltimore Beat Managing Editor Brandon Soderberg has been telling us about the reporting that he and Real News Network's Baynard Woods have been doing of the Gun Trace Task Force trial. Beat Editor-in-Chief Lisa Snowden-McRae is going to stay here with me while we take a quick break, and then we're going to talk about the cover story of the Beat's annual sex issue, a visit to the Millstream Inn Gentlemen's Club. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Today we're having our regular pulse check with the Baltimore Beats editors. Managing Editor Brandon Soderberg gave us his firsthand account of the drama-filled trial of the Baltimore Police Department's Gun Trace Task Force. And now we'll talk with Editor-in-Chief Lisa Snowden-McRae about her visit to the Millstream Inn Gentlemen's Club as part of the Beat's sex issue on stands and online now. Lisa, the Millstream Inn is kind of an institution in Maryland, right?
Yes. I actually remember them from my days at City Paper because they always had the best ads. They were all, like, very creative and funny. And they always came to our parties and always sent a lot of dancers who were very friendly and pretty and handed out free things at our parties. So that's why, you know, we were doing this sex issue. We were trying to plan what we wanted to do. And I was like, I don't think that we ever, you know, even though we kind of worked closely with them at City Paper, I don't think we'd ever talk to them. And also, I had recently gone there. So I was like,
for the first time?
Yes.
And what did you discover there?
I mean, in many ways, it's just like going to any other bar, which I'm sure there are lots of people that are like, duh. But for me, I didn't know. I hadn't been to any place like that. But my husband was hanging out with his friend who had just broken up with his girlfriend and was like kind of feeling down and wanted to do something. So they headed that way. And I called him and he said, why don't you come with us? And so we got there. We hung out with the entertainers, I guess, part of their job. Maureen, who I spoke to, who I interviewed, said that, you know, they don't really see themselves as a strip club per se, which I guess is why it's the gentleman's club. They're more, they see them as entertainers and hostesses, and it's their job to make you feel comfortable. So, you know, sitting there, people would come over, they'd chat with us, they'd be like, what are you eating? What are you drinking? And then they would just go and dance when it was their turn.
Was it what you expected?
I mean, it wasn't like, you know, I am of the age where there was like, I guess like the early 2000s when you could see like rap videos and see kind of that stuff, and it wasn't like a video at all, but you know, it was comfortable. It wasn't intimidating at all. It's a place that I feel like I could just go, and like the girls, the women I should say, were very nice. They're very talented. I went back after my initial visit with Shannon Wallace, our photographer who took the pictures in the paper, and you really saw, first of all, how gorgeous they are, and also that they're athletic. Like, they have these ribbons almost, these big ribbons that hang from the ceiling, and they do all, they can, like, hang upside down and swing from them. Like, it's
that takes it's arm strength.
Yes,
yeah.
Like upper body strength.
For sure. You wrote, quote, what do these places say about the way we view the human form? What agency do dancers have? Are they active participants or just things to be consumed? Close quote. What are your answers?
I mean, I really think it's all and nothing. Like, I think one of the things that we tried to talk about in this issue, because we talk about sex in so many different ways in this issue, as far as, like, you know, consent, and we have Lena Nguyen writing about HIV.
Baltimore's health mm-hmm. commissioner.
Mm-hmm. And you know, sex is such a loaded thing. It can be fun, it can be freeing, but it can also be, you know, there's a lot of baggage that comes with it. And I think that you view strip clubs in that same vein. So, you know, that's what I was trying to kind of hint at. Like, you know, it can be good. For me and my husband and his friend, it was just fun. And from all accounts, the women that work at Millstream enjoy their jobs, and I really hope they do. Of course, you know, there's crap that they have to put up with, I'm sure. So, I mean, it can be everything and nothing all at once.
What else can readers look forward to in the Beats sex issue?
Like I said, we have a really interesting op-ed from Dr. Lena Nguyen, the city's health commissioner, talking about HIV and AIDS, PrEP, which is a pill that you can take every day that helps you not get HIV and AIDS. And kind of she writes very well about kind of reducing the stigma, you know, not feeling the shame to get help, which I think is important. I think that she's a very valuable resource to our city in the way that she's so progressive and open-minded. Oh, I write about Lee's Pint and Shell, which is an oyster bar in Canton. So I was like, you know, oysters, sex issue, it works. Also, they're having a very fun event on Valentine's Day called Love Shucks. So if you do not have a Valentine, you can show up at Lee's Pint and Shell, get discount oysters, and if your significant other, or your ex, I should say, ex-significant other, had left some clothes or shoes or whatever at your house, you can bring them there and they will donate them for you.
I'm struck by the fact that you're calling this the annual sex issue when you've been publishing less than a half a year. How is it so clear that there was going to always be a sex issue?
Because we just want to be positive. You know, we can't. We just try to keep this thing going. Journalism is in a crazy state right now. And I think that, you know, every day I'm unfortunately hearing about places that are closing. But I have to keep, I can't operate on the fact that we're going to close. We're going to keep pushing this thing forward.
Pushing forward. I appreciate your giving us some insights into your new issue.
Thank you.
Thanks
for having me.
Thank you. Lisa Snowden-McRae is editor-in-chief of the Baltimore Beat. We've been talking about the Beat's sex issue, including her visit to the Millstream Inn Gentlemen's Club. Earlier, we spoke with Brandon Soderberg, the Beat's managing editor, about the trial of the Baltimore Police Department Gun Trace Task Force, two stories featured in this week's Baltimore Beat. You can find the link to these and other stories at baltimorebeat.com. We have a link to the Beat at the On the Record page at WIPR.org. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Glad you're listening. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.